Ladies and gentlemen, I'm honored and privileged to ask the elegant, the wonderful Genevieve Young to the CAC Theater stage. Please help me welcome her. I told Jean that I was not going to let this evening go by without involving Gordon in the conversation. So I've got a number of quotes that will hopefully help lead us into some of my questions for Jean. And most of these are taken from Voices in the Mirror, which you can see is highly annotated by its owner. Jean Young was a tall, attractive Chinese woman. And from the moment I saw her, I decided I was going to be an author for Harper & Row. Now, the backstory is, what makes this even more important, is that Doubleday came along and offered twice the amount that Harper was going to pay for the rights. So Gordon was clearly influenced by his prospective editor. Jean, what is your earliest memory of Gordon?
Well, it was a life story that appeared about maybe 6 months before I met Gordon. It was a wonderful story about Flavio, who was the a poor boy in a favela in Brazil, and the story of his terrible life. And it was a very compassionate, wonderful story. It was just like the old life, which had become boring and rather stodgy in recent years. But this was like the old life. And I thought, this is really a wonderful story. And as I leafed to the back to find out who had written it, I saw a picture of Gordon. I was surprised. I didn't know that life had a black photographer. And that was the first time I laid eyes on Gordon. And a few weeks later, Carl Midens, who was another wonderful life photographer, wonderful man, came leading Gordon by the hand, who had 7 pages of a novel that he wanted to write, and introduced him to my boss, Evan Thomas, who made him an offer, and Gordon accepted it. I didn't know anything about this stuff. And I remember standing in front of Evan's desk saying, "Evan, you're crazy, you're crazy. He's only written 7 pages. What makes you think he can write any more?" And Gordon later on said he wondered whether he could write any more either.
Gordon tells us that Jean, my editor, sensing this turmoil, began nursing me through it, advising, constructing, helping me make peace with it. But Jean, observing such pages without sympathy, persisted. And lovely though she was, at times I couldn't help but think of her as a tyrant. What was it like to be Gordon Park's editor?
Well, I have to say he was very obedient. But Gordon had a tremendous urge to tell his story. He had fewer tools than a lot of professional writers. I have never quite been clear about how much schooling he had, but he certainly didn't go much past the beginning of high school. So everything he'd learned on his own by reading, thinking about it. So he still had fewer tools, but he had such a strong desire to write, to tell his story, that it just came out. And with a lot of pushing and shoving, we got it into really its best form, which is what I think an editor does. You try to find your author's best way of telling his story, and that's what we did.
What was his creative process? And we have been talking over the last couple of days, and you've indicated that Gordon was such a perfectionist that he wanted that first chapter to be perfect.
God, yeah.
How did he go about his work, and how did you help him?
He worked all the time, that's true, but he was also a perfectionist, and he could not keep on going until he had the back perfect, which meant he kept on writing the first chapter and the second chapter over and over again. I kept on saying, "Gordon, get it all down, then we can fix it." But he couldn't do that. So the beginnings of his books always were really completely worked over. Then after a while, he'd loosen up and the rest of the book would come, and he wouldn't insist on redoing every single chapter. He would do it in lumps of maybe 3 or 4 chapters. But he really worked all the time, and usually in the middle of the night. Because in the daytime, the phone rang constantly, so.
Is it true that he always had music playing in the background?
Yes. And I still remember all the pieces that he played, yeah.
I think this is a wonderful story, again, from Choice of Weapons that Gordon tells. And Gene can verify whether it's accurate or not, but I think, as Gordon tells it, it's a great story. Working on the new book brought Gene and me closer when I returned to New York. Our friendship took on an added warmth, and no longer did I mind her pushing me harder towards becoming a better writer. At dinner one night, I allowed caution to wear off. Looking up from a big steak as I abandoned it, quote, "Gene, forgive me, but I think I have fallen in love with my editor." The reply attributed to Gene was, "It's the wine, Gordon." Authors do silly things like that from time to time. Gene, when did you realize that your relationship was more than a professional one?
It took a long time, really. The thing about Gordon is he was never there. He was always somewhere else and writing letters. And I got fonder and fonder of him, and every time he came back, I was really gladder to see him. But I was married, he was married, he had a little girl. So, you know, matters did not progress for really, literally years until finally we decided we really had to get married. And so I got a divorce, he got a divorce. And I liked his wife a lot, and she's really been a terrific woman all the way through. We got married, but it really took almost a decade to do this. But I think his recollection is a little romantic because I remember it being sitting in the bar of Louis XIV when I was about to catch a train to go home to Great Neck. And I remember getting up rather indignantly and leaving to go to Penn Station. It was really rather more prosaic, I think. Gordon was always a great romantic.
He was indeed.
Yeah.
I like his story better, too. We had the opportunity this morning to visit Special Collections, and Dr. Madway and Dr. Gilstrap and Lucy Waldrop and others, they pulled out some things for Genevieve to look at and Peter to look at. And one of the files that Genevieve was able to see was a file about this thick of letters back and forth. And we all remarked at the time how people do not write letters, do not correspond, let alone save them. And these letters were literally from all over the world, weren't they?
And Gordon saved them. Gordon saved everything. Okay, so Gordon saved my letters and his letters, my letters to him and his letters to me, which I think is quite remarkable.
Gordon again says, "Later, I lay in bed thinking, remembering those early years. She was lovely then, even lovelier now. I adored her eyes. When moonlight touched her face, it took on the color of everything that was beautiful." Obviously, Gordon has written vividly, Gene, about you and your relationship and your marriage. Did you agree with all these sentiments, or was... when you saw that in writing, what was your reaction?
I never saw that in writing. This is the first time I've ever seen it. What was it in?
Voices in the Mirror. Page 322.
You know, that Nan Talese politely sent me the manuscript of that book. And I'm an editor. I read all the time. I had piles of manuscripts, and I never read it. I mean, I'm sure she wanted me to fix any dates because all the dates were wrong, but I never looked at it. I thought, you know, let Gordon tell his story. It can't be that wrong. So that's one of the things. And I never read it, so to this day, I haven't read that book.
Well, you've talked about Gordon being a romantic in your daily life. Did he talk to you this way, or was your marriage like it was this is your life and you did what you had to do, the routine things? Or did he communicate to you these wonderful sentiments as you were
living? Well, not in that flowery prose, but, you know, I really knew he loved me. And he was very huggy and affectionate.
Good.
And we had too little time together. I mean, he was always going somewhere, basically. But I remember one funny evening, we took all the Gordon loved candles. We had candles all over the house, so we took all the candles together, melted them down, and put them into bowls. And we had a great time making new candles out of old. That's the only time I remember spending a whole night not doing anything except chuckling and having a good time.
Fantastic.
Very rare.
Fantastic. And it was just in the apartment at the United
yeah.
Nations
Plaza. Mm-hmm.
In Voices in the Mirror, there is a photograph of you and Gordon in bed working. And the photograph is by the renowned Alfred Eisenstadt of Life magazine. Could you tell us the background of that photograph?
If I could take that photograph back, boy, would I do it, because I really got completely razzed by everybody I knew. What happened was Alfred Eisenstadt had just retired, and he was much loved by all his fellow photographers and the editors. And the one and only idea he'd ever had, story idea he'd ever had, was to do a story on Gordon and me. I wasn't particularly anxious to be in People magazine, but they came. He came at about 10 o'clock with this very pretty girl, and he spent most of the day there explaining what he was doing to her. And so he took a lot of photographs, but one of them he wanted us to get into bed, and I balked. I said, no, I'm not going to do that. And Gordon said, get in. So I got in, because he really couldn't bear to cross Izzy. I mean, he just loved Izzy. So if Izzy wanted us to go to bed, we went to bed. But I really would take it back if I could.
So it was a stage photograph.
It sure was.
Well, you look so serious with your pencil editing.
I know. It's just, that whole thing was just really a disaster.
And when we were talking about Mr. Eisenstadt, if you remember the photograph that's on the poster that we've been using to promote this event, that is one of his photographs. Talking about photographs, Gene, do you have a favorite photograph by Gordon?
I don't really think so. He has so many. Of course, I have the photographs I have hanging in my house, which has my jewelry and our jewelry together. That's a favorite photograph because it's very nostalgic. The blue bird, you know, mm-hmm. I like because I own it. But no, I mean, I like almost all of his realistic photographs. I was not crazy about his abstractions, which he did later in life. And I liked his color photographs a lot.
What about, do you have a favorite photograph of Gordon? I mean, obviously, loving this man, I'm familiar with lots of photographs, and think he was remarkably photogenic.
Yeah.
And there are a number of photographs of Gordon. Do you have a favorite of those that you particularly
like? Well, Izzy took some that I liked a lot, but the one I really like is the one by Adger.
In your publication.
Yeah. And it's on my refrigerator, and his eyes follow me when I'm working in the kitchen. Yeah.
I obviously can't see it, but it's...
Yeah, but Gordon is very funny. Gordon was really, really... He always had to direct his photographs. In other words, whoever is photographing him, he had to order around, you know, so... very often he's looking very grim because he's not approving of what's happening.
What about a favorite book or poem? Any of his poems that were particularly striking to you that you really liked?
Not really. I have a tin ear for poetry, and I really never worked on his poems because I really don't... It's not something I'm particularly interested in. So, no, I don't have any. It always wounded him that I wouldn't work on his poems, but I never did.
My question that I had thought about was, and we've touched upon it a little bit, but I've got a particular vignette that might help lead into further discussion for our audience. My question was, how would you describe your marriage? But the little story that caught my eye was the... Gordon talks about the dress that he bought for you on Park Avenue after you were named vice president at Lippincott. You remember that story?
It wasn't a dress. It was a coat. Does he talk about it?
He talks about it in the book and how you... my recollection, Gene, is that initially he wanted to buy you a dress or something that was extremely expensive.
Let me tell the story because it's really hilarious.
Great.
So I called him in the morning and said, I had told him once I liked this store. So I called him, I said, they've just made me a vice president. I thought that he thought that was very nice. A little later he called me back and said, I'll meet you at, what was it called, Martha's on Madison Avenue. So I went there and he had this beautiful outfit hanging up. It was a sort of all silvery sequins on top and a gray flannel skirt. And I tried it on and they pinned it onto me. It was really, truly beautiful. And I took it off and I was sitting there and I just happened to look at the tag. And first I thought it was a serial number. It was 7,600 and something like that. And I said, Gordon, do you know this costs as much as a car? And he said, ah. And I said, Gordon, this is 7,000 something dollars. He said, what? It was a Norman Norell. He had photographed Norell's clothes. Of course, he had never known how much they cost, you know, because you don't need to know things like that. So we went into this panic, and I said, no. I said very loudly, I can't let you buy me a dress that's that important. So we ran around the store looking for something to buy to take the place of that, and we bought a coat that I never really liked very much. It had a huge fur collar. We escaped. Phew! That's the story of that.
Well, that reminds me of some of our discussions in the last couple of days, and I think you remarked, and that Gordon touches on it in some of his writing, that Leslie, his very youngest daughter, he and she did not share opinions as to clothes. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, every pre-Christmas time, he would take Leslie to buy her Easter outfit. And his idea of an Easter outfit was a nice little hat and a nice little coat and white socks and Mary Jane shoes. Well, Leslie was having none of this, you know, and I was there in the middle, you know, having these huge battles up and down Bloomingdale's floor. We really never settled this, okay, but we probably ended up buying Leslie blue jeans and a little coat, which I knew she would never wear, but made Gordon happy to think that she would be wearing it. And on our wedding day, they had this big fight because he had this dress for her in mind, and she wouldn't wear it. So there's a picture, I think, is it in somewhere, of Gordon and Leslie having this confrontation over her dress, and she got to wear her dress. It was a little play dress, yeah.
And let's pursue that a little bit, because Gordon obviously was a dapper dresser himself.
Yeah.
And I think I heard you talk about that he would have small suitcases that he would carry around with his clothes.
Yeah, a bunch of little Gurkhas, like little dogs. Right? He didn't ever have one big suitcase, yeah.
Was he? Did he shop for his own clothes?
Well, he went to Hellman in London to have his suits made. And he always wore the same black knitted Dior tie. And shirts, I guess he had shirts. I never saw him buy a shirt in his life. But, he was a really good... He cared a lot about how people looked. And I think that is probably a minority syndrome thing, you know, that really we always had to be well turned out.
Yeah. Did he offer you suggestions on your clothes?
Yeah, and he had such old-fashioned ideas. He liked these fur boas, you know. Uh-huh. I didn't like, you know, with the head biting the tail, that kind of thing. I was pretty strong-minded about what I wanted to wear.
As we've talked about, and I think everybody recognizes, you and Gordon maintained a significant friendship after your divorce. And Gordon writes, sometimes I am inclined to think that ambition carved my image out of stone, that the persistence of it crushed Sally, Elizabeth, and Genevieve under its weight. Fortunately, those hostilities that assailed us failed to hold us in bondage. I am still there if they should need me, and if I should be in need, they are there for me. How were you able to maintain that close relationship with Gordon?
It was easier to have a little distance from him, in other words, and not be responsible for absolutely everything in the household. I mean, what happened was I really just wore out. I took care of the books, you know, I mean, dealing with the income and the outgo and the cleaning lady and getting the piano tuned and almost everything in Gordon's life and while he created. And he really needed a nanny and a lawyer and an accountant. And after a while, I just got tired. So when I removed myself a bit, and he survived, I knew he would, we were much friendlier.
Did you?
I wasn't resentful anymore, yeah.
How much contact did you have in those later years? I mean, how often would you see each other? Would you talk on the telephone?
Oh, there were actually a long time when I, you know, would maybe talk to him once a month. But then when he started getting rather frail, I sort of came back in and came to entertain him. You know, we'd have little lunches. I'd bring the sandwiches. And one of the things we did, because we had to have something to do, was to have him sign all his photographs. We did that, and he had an adoring neighbor, Claire Yaffa. Claire came too, so we'd have a little lunch every week and sign photographs and have a good time.
Fantastic. Yeah. And what about Sally and Elizabeth? Would you say you were close, or did you have a...
Sally I hardly ever met. I think I only met her once.
Really?
When the opening of the Corcoran Gallery, Sally was there, and... I gathered us all up for a photograph of Gordon's three wives. But that's the only time I met her. She was quite old and living in a senior residence by that time. Liz and I were good friends. I mean, I always liked Liz, and I think Liz always liked me. And she remarried and lives out in the West Coast now.
Yes, she.
Mm-hmm. But when she was, you know, we shared Leslie. And
yes.
It was just very easy. You know, Leslie was never resented me. I mean, they called me Mama Jean, mm-hmm. and she, you know, we'd never had any problems over the custody.
How old was Leslie at that when you got married?
Well, starting, she was about 7 or 8.
And is Leslie still, is she in New York?
She's in New York. She's a chef. She has two actually beautiful boys. She married a chef.
And do you see her at all?
Yeah, I do.
And do you have contact with Elizabeth, even though she's on the
West
Coast?
No, Liz is out on the West Coast, and I haven't seen her for a long time.
We all think of and are proud to claim Gordon as a Kansan. Mm-hmm. Did he talk much about Kansas, or growing up in Fort Scott? Really anything that would indicate to you his feelings about Kansas?
Not really a whole lot. You know, Gordon was really forward-facing. He thought and talked about the future. Once in a while, he'd mention something about one of his boyhood friends, you know, who he really felt close to still. But I don't remember him talking much about Kansas at all. He'd done the movie. I think he'd gotten it out of his system, you know, the nostalgia, etc. You know, so we always talked about what he was about to do.
Yeah. Well, and that sounds exactly like him. But we do know that he obviously experienced racism and discrimination in Kansas. And for a while, I think my perception is that he was bitter about that.
Oh, yeah.
And did he talk about his feelings about that or discrimination in general? Did you have conversation about that?
Not really. I could tell when he felt, for instance, there were times in New York he could not get a cab. Okay, taxis just bypass black people. Okay, and that would make him mad. He never talked about it. I used to be able to feel sometimes when he felt angry at something that somebody said or something people did.
As a mixed couple, did you perceive any different sort of treatment in New York or around?
No. However, when we went to Vail, the first year that we were married, no, I think it was the year before we were married, we were just living together, Gordon had both his grandson, Alan, and Leslie, who was 8. And I thought, what am I going to do? And Alan was like 13. I thought, what are we going to do with 2 ill-matched kids in the city? So we all dragged them off to Vail, And the kids learn how to ski. I learned how to ski because of that, and so did Gordon. And years later, they did a book on the beginnings of Vail, and there we are in this book. Apparently, the town was agog. And I had no idea. But it's mentioned in the book.
Well, and I know that Alain is a devoted skier still.
Yes, exactly. We started him on his career of skiing.
And we know that his parents were obviously very important to Gordon and very influential. And my personal belief that it was Sarah that really laid a guiding hand on his shoulder. Did he talk about memories of Sarah and Andrew?
He did, and not about his father, about his mother. And his mother, I kept on saying, she couldn't have been a living saint. And Gordon would say, yes, she was. It couldn't have been that good. Yes, she was. He really thought that Sarah was the best woman he'd ever met in his life, and that she had no flaws.
So. And when working on the learning tree, was that especially apparent at that point in time?
Well, that's when I was saying, she can't be that good, you know. He was, she was, Gordon said, yeah, and it stayed in there.
Going back, another story that I've had the privilege of hearing relates to the Rolls Royce, Gordon's Rolls Royce.
Yeah.
Would you tell that story to the audience?
Well, Gordon was in California making, I think, Shaft, and he had to rent a car, and the studio would pay for it, but no, Gordon wouldn't rent a car. Gordon bought a Rolls Royce and for quite a lot of money, and then he spent quite a lot more money having it painted blue with a faint red line around the thing. And I remember yelling at him and saying, you know, Gordon, it's just crazy. You know, the studio would pay for a car, so why are you spending all this money for a Rolls Royce? He always wanted a Rolls Royce. And I remember I was out there with him. It had a terrible electrical system. It just quit on the Santa Monica freeway. And I learned one thing, which is that nobody stops for a Rolls Royce. We just stood there. Well, after he was finished with Shaft, it turned out he sold the Rolls Royce for a lot more money than he would have gotten as a refund for his rental car. So he really came out okay on that car. And he loved having it.
Oh,
it was
bet.
One of those old Rolls Royces, not a new one.
Now, did he drive, or did you have a driver? Did he have
a
driver?
Oh, he drove, yeah.
I think we've got a microphone, or I know we do. We might take a minute here. Are there any questions from the audience that somebody would want to pose to Ms. Young?
I'm not afraid to get this started. And I don't know, Gene, if this is too forward of a question. Growing up in Kansas, his mother dying when he was at such a formative age, being shuffled off to a sister in, you know, many states away, and growing up with racism and such forward discrimination, that would mark a person. And for many people, it would really wound them throughout their life. How did that early experience mark Gordon that you were ever able to see as he continued on in his life?
Sorry, I couldn't quite hear that. Can you paraphrase?
I will try. Growing up and experiencing that racism and that discrimination in Kansas, mm-hmm. And then losing his mother at an early age, being shuffled off to St. Paul to live with a sister, I think Patricia commented that that's going to mark a person, that's going to impact a person, potentially quite negatively. Did you ever see that implant on Gordon? Or I guess I would supplement, how do you think he was able to overcome that?
I think that's what gave him his drive to succeed. That we always joke that if he didn't succeed, he always could become a short order cook. He was really a terrific cook. No, I think that's what drove him, was his memory of all the slings and arrows and the losses that he'd had. But it didn't embitter him.
Good, good. Well, and that's clear because he accomplished so much and was so gracious in his own right. Yes, ma'am.
With all the texting, can you hear me okay?
Can you hear her, Jean?
No, I'm sorry. I have bad hearing.
I'll try to repeat.
Yeah. Okay. With texting, all the social media and all, what advice do you think Gordon might offer young teenagers who are aspiring to go into journalism and photography and those type careers?
Question, Jean, is that in today's world of texting and social media, what do you think Gordon would advise someone who wants to be a writer or get into the creative arts with the lack of real writing experience and the correspondence that we talked about? What would Gordon think about social media?
Well, I think he'd be awash. I mean, I don't think he was never technologically very adept. Even girls would come and sit at his feet to talk about f-stops and his camera, and he would look just dazed and bored. He just did it. And I think that if anybody wanted to know how to write, he'd just say, just do it, which is what he did. He just did it. When he decided he was going to write a novel, he just did it. Takes guts, but that's, I think, what his advice would be. Do it.
And it strikes me that it would be very appropriate to ask you the question, Jean, with your background, very distinguished background as an editor and in the publishing industry. What advice would you give to young people who want to get into writing and the creative arts?
Well, you know, as an editor, I feel that too many people, there are too many writers. And it's really hard, and it takes a lot of luck to succeed as a writer, and it doesn't necessarily mean that you're good or bad, that you fail or succeed. So I think you have to have the kind of drive that Gordon had to keep on doing it. And again, I think you just have to do it. I don't think there are any courses that you can take. I think reading a lot helps. But in the end, just do it.
Is there anything that I haven't covered, Genevieve, that, and particularly with regard to your experience over the last two or three days being with us here in Wichita, anything that you would want to tell the audience or anything that you'd like to discuss, get into about Gordon or what
we're trying to do here?
I
was really impressed when I went to visit the library to see what they'd done with. I packed up Gordon's papers in 144 cartons in a huge rush in the middle of the General Assembly in New York, which means you can't get in or out of his building at the time. And I'm so impressed at how much they found that I didn't know existed, all his early photographs and writings, and how carefully they've been kept and in folders and filed, and we'll be able to find them again. And letters that he'd written to me, which I was thought was maybe lost. In fact, that's why Ted drove us 300 miles for me to see if they were at KSU, turned out to be here and beautifully arranged, you know, so that you could actually follow the sequence of our lives together. So I think that's the thing that really impressed me the most, is how well the library has treated his papers and how much rich stuff there was in the papers. There was also a lot of garbage. I don't know what they did with them. Like, there was a box. I know there was a box full of Christmas cards. Gordon kept everything, you know, so.
And how would he, where was all this material in the apartment?
All over the damn place. I mean, when I was living there, Gordon had a study, and we had a bedroom, and we had a living room and dining room, and everything was fine. After I had left, things started creeping out of the study onto the dining table and out beyond the dining table. It just started overflowing all over the place, and because he never threw anything away, and he never could find anything either. He always said, you know, I know where everything is. He didn't know where everything was. And once in a while, his assistant, Joanna, would throw things into a carton and take it downstairs to the storage room without any organization, really. So the fact that the library was able to sort through all this stuff, you know, the value and the... I have to ask Lorraine what she did with all those Christmas cards.
Yes, ma'am.
I wanted to ask if, Jean, you feel... It's actually kind of two questions. First of all, what your personal favorite genre or medium that Gordon, he mastered so many. If there's a certain area that you really enjoyed the most on a personal level, and then also if you could say something about what you think, of course, it remains to be seen, but has going forward in the future, what you think might be one of the most important types of work that he did. He just did so much. It's overwhelming to think about it.
Clearly, Gordon was a Renaissance man with regard to his creative activities. Photography, poetry, writing, composing, ballet. I think the question was, of all those means of expression and creativity, did you have a favorite of those?
Well, of course, being a word person, I liked his books the best. And he was such a good writer, really. I respected his photography. I mean, he really had a gift, obviously. But I don't really understand a lot about photography, but I understand a lot about writing. And I think that A Choice of Weapons was his best book, his nonfiction book.
It's a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part of the question was, as we move forward, as we go into the next several years, what of those creative activities, will any one of those become more important? Will the focus be on photography as opposed to his books or with regard to his composing, his music? Any thoughts about what the future shining will be?
I think thanks to Peter Coonhart and the Gordon Parks Foundation, that what will be important, because they're doing such a good job with it, is his photography, which was basically his professional career. He was sort of an amateur at everything else, as a writer, as a musician. You know, he couldn't write music. I mean, he couldn't read or write music, because when his sister was taking piano lessons, he could do everything by ear, so he never bothered to take any music lessons. And film, too, I think, was kind of an amateur effort. So his photography was what he was a pro at, and I think that that's what's going to last.
And that was his profession, although I think that his work in the film industry and what he did for the African-American community and the pride that Shaft brought to so many people, I think that is a...
There was a lot of backbiting, too, you know.
Well, tell us about
from
that.
The black community about how it showed... you know, a criminal element. There was a lot. He was quite wounded by that. It's the fact that the black community really, there was a section of it that criticized Shaft as being the wrong message to send to young people. And of course, it was enormously popular just for that reason, is because it showed, you know, a strong guy
exactly.
and is black. Yes.
Exactly.
Could I just thank you very much? It's really a helpful thing to know. I just wanted to say on that note about the movie Shaft, if it helps at all, it was the theme song of my senior class in 1973. So we appreciated it in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Okay? We really did.
She was saying that the theme song from Shaft was her high school, her class's theme.
That's hilarious. I met Isaac. What was his name?
And
Isaac.
We had to stand every time it was played by the pep band.
It was very much honored. Little recorder, I remember, and he came in the elevator. He was wearing a full mink coat all the way down to his and a mink hat, and he was carrying his recorder in his hand. He was playing the Shaft theme, okay. And a woman came in with her mink coat. And he looked up and down. His mink coat was a lot better. That's what I remember about Isaac Hayes.
That
was the most incredible mink coat I've ever seen.
Well, the story I've heard about the creation, the writing of Shaft was that, in fact, I've heard Mr. Hayes say this himself, that he got this assignment to write the theme song, very excited about it, and as he would develop ideas, he'd share those with Gordon. And Gordon would say, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And Isaac would do it. In a sense, I got the feeling that it was Gordon that really wrote the theme song. Another question?
Yes. Gene, I knew some of Mr. Parks, Gordon Parks' family. I grew up with his nieces and some of the his brother's children. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that he ever wrote about his family, or that if he included his family in any of his works at all. I don't think there's too much known about his family other than he was from a large family.
Good question. This lady has indicated that she knew some of Gordon's family here in town. And do you have a recollection or knowledge of whether, either directly or indirectly, Gene, that he would include or make reference or somehow add his family into his writing? Did he ever write about his family, per se?
Except for the learning tree and the beginning of A Choice of Weapons, I don't think he ever wrote about his family. He didn't even write about his kids much.
No,
I don't remember anything that he's written about it. No.
Well, talking about the composing, and one of the treasures that we have discovered in the collected papers, and it's talked about in the book, a number of receipts where his mother purchased on time a piano down in Fort Scott. And obviously Sarah kept these receipts of a $3 payment here and a $5 payment there, and ultimately was able to purchase this piano for Gordon.
And his sister.
And his sister. Mm-hmm. So it's just not only that the story that tells of Sarah's pride in wanting to have a piano for the family, paying for it on time, keeping the receipts, and then for Gordon to keep those receipts. But it was my understanding that in his composing, he developed a numerical system to mm-hmm. help him compose.
Yeah.
And would he, and you talked about working late at night, would he be at the piano? Would he be composing occasionally?
Yeah.
And
he
how
would he
do that?
But almost on his deathbed, he was still writing his little system, you know, which we found by his bed. I don't really understand exactly what he was doing. I think nobody probably did. But he'd play the piano in the middle of the night, yes. But he very often played things that he'd already composed. So I don't know where... He must have done it in his head, basically,
yeah.
Because I don't remember him testing things, you know.
And we talked about, and again, this is a personal question, if you'll allow me, but it strikes me as of interest that at your apartment, Gordon, the telephone is ringing all the time, gets into a creative activity later in the day, and I know that he liked to cook. Would he be the chef in the family? Would he cook your meals? Would you eat at home a lot?
And what we ate at home a lot.
And what time was dinner in the Parks household?
Well, I used to get home at about 6. Gordon would have just started working because he was a late worker. And I'd usually cook. And we'd eat. And the housekeeper usually stayed just about to the point where she could wash the dishes. And then Gordon would go off and work some more again. But during the day, I guess the phone just rang constantly. He couldn't really do anything during the day. So,
friends, business opportunities, ideas, creative.
Yeah, just all that and more.
And bringing the story back to Kansas, if I may, I think it's a wonderful story of how Gordon decided towards the end, at the end, that he wanted to come home to Fort Scott and be buried in Evergreen Cemetery. Did he share with you, communicate to you at some point in time, this is definitely what I want, this is what I think I want, I've made up my mind, and how was there a discussion?
No, actually, there was no discussion. Gordon he hated to talk about death, okay? He was afraid of death. And you'll see in his books that death to him is a very ominous, scary thing. But he once said to Katie Strickler that, I want my body to go back to Fort Scott. And when we were talking about his funeral at the Riverside Church, I said, you know, this will be such a relief when we can just take Gordon's ashes to Fort Scott. She said, ashes? He wants his body to go back to Fort Scott. So we sent his body back to Fort Scott, and we had an open coffin there, you know. But he must have mentioned it to Katie. He never said anything to me about it.
Mr. McAfee?
37 years ago, that's what this took. It was 37 years ago that Gordon and I were playing tennis at a tennis tournament in New Orleans. With Bill Cosby and Arthur Ashe and a few other people. And we got to talking, and I said, I know your older brother, Clemmy. He's always magnificently dressed. He works downtown where I work. And I said, and he now serves on a couple of boards, or I serve on a couple of boards with him. And he's always been a marvelous, you know, person to be around. And it's a pleasure to meet you finally. I said, now, I just finished this building at Wichita State University. And I think you need to come and do a one-man show there. He looked at me and he says, I'm never going back to Kansas. And I looked at him, I got up, and I went to the phone. And I called Bobby Humphrey, who was a professor here. And I said, Bobby, I'm having dinner with Gordon Parks. She said, Charlie, he won't return our phone calls. He won't answer our letters. Call Martin Bush and see if you can get a time for him. Martin Bush was the director of the Ulrich at the time. I called Martin. Martin says, I'll change any date second semester. I went back to the table, and Gordon and his grandson and I were sitting there. And I said, I have it all set up for you to come back to Wichita State. He said, you really want me to do that? I said, I really want you to do that. And that's where this sort of all started happening. There were 250 some pieces here. They got another director at the museum who mistakenly sent them all back to New York in a box. Now, the beautiful part about that was those were the things that he used to create Half Past Autumn, which made him an awful lot of money with all of the different editions that he did. I only want to stand up here and to thank all of you who have brought it this far. And Gene, I am so proud that you have blessed us to come to Wichita. And young man, Coonhart, I am very pleased that you're escorting her all over this place. And Ted, I can't say enough for you, because, you know, you were the guy who just picked up the ball from the former president. And I never will forget the first time I sat in your office and we called him on the phone. 37 years, folks. That's what this took.
I just want to say that it's been a extreme pleasure to have Genevieve with us, to have Peter with us, to come out from New York City to be here and help us celebrate this culminating event of our centennial activity. And it is thrilling to me to know that when I, again, thinking back 100 years ago, what was going on in Fort Scott, Kansas tonight and tomorrow. And you may know the story. If you do, too bad, because I'm going to tell it again. If you don't, you'll enjoy this. But as Gordon describes in a couple of his books, 100 years ago tomorrow, his birth was not an immediate success. In fact, they thought that Gordon was not going to live or was not alive. And there was a white doctor in Fort Scott that said, here, let's put the baby in some ice cold water. Gordon lets out a huge yell, and the rest of it is, of course, history. But that doctor, that white doctor who was attending Sarah and helping Gordon come into our world, was Dr. Gordon. So now you know why it's Gordon Parks. Again, thank you very much for being here. We are pleased that you've joined us tonight. I hope you have had a wonderful time, as good a time as I have had having this dialogue, this public dialogue with Genevieve. I want to thank her so much for sharing No holds barred. So thank you for taking my questions. And with that, I'm going to draw this evening, Teresa, is this, draw the evening to a conclusion, draw the centennial events to a conclusion. But I would, as a closing request, ask each of you tomorrow, think about Gordon Parks. Think about Fort Scott, Kansas. And think about this remarkable life that we are so blessed to be able to share, to know, and to learn more about, and to keep that legacy alive. Thank you very much.